So by way of motivation, let's take a moment to think about what our potential is as human beings. The kind of minds and hearts that we have. The kind of growth we've done in our life up to this point. The beauty that we've created and the kindness that we've shown. Maybe the skills that we've developed. In the Buddhist worldview, we have an amazing capacity. And so we want to tap into that as we enter this topic today. As we try to develop this compassionate heart, we're aware of the suffering in the world. It's in the news every day. And we know that we can work with our minds in a way to help us to be able to engage with the world and all of the suffering and problems and all of the joys even, without becoming lost. So let's take a moment now to cultivate the highest aspiration that you could see for your spiritual life. What would that look like? Yeah, so we always take time to set our motivation because from the Buddhist perspective, it's the most important thing in terms of what directs our mind and our speech and our actions. So we do this at the beginning of every meditation session, teaching, and things like that. And then at the end, we dedicate the merit so that we steer this virtue that we've created to an aspiration. So we're studying this book, An Open-Hearted Life. And this was just, for those of you who are new, this is a text that was written by our abbess here, Venerable Thubten Chodron, and a psychologist at Eastern Washington named Russell Coltz. And so it's combining both the Buddhist perspective on developing a compassionate heart and psychological perspective, which is kind of new in the last few decades, actually, a lot of the research, and it's a very active area of research. And now we're on chapter 10. And so we've already covered a lot in the book about what is compassion, what isn't compassion, and why we should develop it. So we've got some aspiration now to develop compassion. And then in chapter 10, it's actually, this chapter is written by Russell Coltz, the psychologist. And I'm going to, so he writes from a psychological perspective, and I'm going to bring in the Buddhist worldview a little bit as we go through it. But basically, in this chapter, he's asking us to look at our mind and see how the mind works and how it affects our behavior. And so, in the Buddhist worldview, the mind is actually that experiences. It's not, it's a very broad term. It includes like memory and things like that, but it also includes feeling things and thinking and just everything we experience is included within the world of the mind. So it includes emotions, attitudes, thoughts, things like that. And in this chapter, what they're looking at is how these things interact. And the perspective I take on this is one that's taught in the early commentaries in the Pali Canon, which explains different types of causality. And they kind of break it down in these commentaries to five types of causality. And this topic of this chapter actually relates to probably two of those primarily. So in that early view, and it still seems to work pretty well now, they talk about, you know, we know that causes lead to results. We're all steeped in science in our culture, so we get that. And so in the Buddhist worldview back at that time, the way they described it, I'm not going to use their words because they wouldn't make any sense to us, but the meaning of them were there was like processes that happened that were like inorganic, like what happens with rocks, you know, and things interacting on a, just an inorganic level. And then there was like the organic or biological level, things that are alive. And then there's like the, what they call citta or mind or psyche, you might say. So there's like a almost a psychological level of causality that happens. And then there's also the karmic, which is a Buddhist principle, that our actions, there's an ethical dimension to our actions, and that they have results. And so, you know, what goes around comes around kind of thing, in an ethical dimension. And then there's a dharmic kind of causality. So this chapter, a lot, is about the citta, the mind or the psyche. And in the way it's described by the person who taught us about the early Pali commentary, Bhikkhu Bodhi, he talks about this as the order of causation that takes place between acts of consciousness, the order holding sway over the mind and the mental processes, things that occur between the acts of consciousness or mental events. So this is what this chapter is actually about for the most part. And it's the title of this chapter is Compassionate Understanding of Emotions. So he's trying to help us to understand kind of, in a way, how we're psychologically wired, you might say. And it's more than psychological. I'd say it's also maybe the biological, or better said, maybe physiological level, the mind-body connection, we might say, in our terminology. So when Russell writes this chapter, he brings up different aspects of the mind that are really reminiscent of things that have been studied a lot in psychology for decades about like fight and flight responses and all the physiological things that happen in the body. But what he's asking us, and this is actually, I read some studies yesterday, there's a lot of research on this. It's very interesting, and it seems like, you know, it will be beautiful as they continue to look into these things. But what this chapter is trying to do is ask us to look at, from the perspective of our emotions, what's happening in the mind, both with our positive emotions and our negative emotions. And so he starts the chapter like this. Do you ever look around the world and wonder how it is that we humans do such crazy, stupid things? That's his opening line. Perhaps you occasionally look back at your own life and see decisions you've made that make you cringe, almost as if you can't believe it was you. So, you know, if we didn't reflect, how might we talk about those things, you know, if you had no reflection? Well, then he goes on. We may try to explain those things that we do by attaching labels. He's short-sighted. I've got no self-control. People are idiots. In other words, we use language, if we don't reflect, that's very, like, judgmental or diagnostic or criticizing or interpreting. And that's not always so helpful. In fact, at the Abbey here, we study nonviolent communication to help us to quit doing that so much, or at least recognize when we're doing it. And that's a kind of a psychologically based communication system, and also, what's that word, conflict resolution kind of method of communication created by Marshall Rosenberg. And that helps us to at least be aware. I mean, a lot of things make us be aware of that labeling, but that gives this that kind of language that we learn in nonviolent communication gives us better tools, better language, better word choices to actually accomplish what we're trying to do, which in that nonviolent communication, you're basically trying to have compassionate communication. The motivation is compassion, and that's what this chapter is about, compassion. So in order to develop, Russell continues, in order to develop compassion, we need a non-judgmental approach imbued with acceptance and kindness. So he's asking us to put down the labels, disarm, and bring something else to mind. So in this book, as I said, we've already covered why, what compassion is and what it isn't. Basically, in the Buddhist sense, and Russell adopts this, compassion is the wish to for others not to have suffering or its causes. So it's not like pity. There's a lot of things it's not, and we've kind of covered that already. It's not personal distress on seeing suffering. It's actually a really powerful and strong state of mind that helps us to have this wish. It's a mental. It's not action either. It's mental. It's a mental state that you cultivate, where you are wishing that someone wouldn't be suffering, and that they could be alleviated from their suffering and the causes. So that's what compassion is. So understanding, as Russell goes on, understanding our emotions, how our emotions work, is a big help to trying to do this. So he's saying, he's having us start off, this is a very experiential chapter, as you did in the meditation as well. So he wants us to bring an emotion to mind that you've had recently, and then he suggests it, like maybe anger or anxiety. Anger he's going to talk about later in the chapter, so I chose to pursue anxiety, and I'd like to stick more with the version of anxiety that relates to fear. And because they've done so much research on this area of the mind-body connection related to fear of a perceived threat, the fight and flight, I'm going to use that as we go through these things, because he wants us to look closely and find how these emotions impact your mind in a number of different ways, this interplay of mental events that we were talking about at the very beginning, the citta or mind-psyche type of causality. So we're trying to see how these things interact. He would say emotions organize our minds. I think that might be a little strong, but they definitely impact. He says emotions organize our minds by affecting many aspects of our mental experience. So he's asking us to look closely. So he looks at six different things that he goes through in the chapter, and we'll go through in a few scenarios here this morning. And these are bodily experience, attention, thinking and reasoning, imagery, motivation, and behavior. So we'll pick this one of fear of a perceived threat, something that really, you know, is going to harm you. Actually, I think once I heard of somebody picking up a piano that was on somebody to save their life, or even people picking up cars to save people's life, because they get this huge adrenaline and all these other hormones too rush, and the strength of your body is incredible then. In fact, I've known wrestlers that use this before they go into a wrestling match that will actually generate this state so that they're stronger. And it's true. Physiologically, you can do this through your hormones. You can actually have more strength than you would have. So somebody who usually couldn't pick up a piano actually will pick up a piano and save somebody, and then they'll be suffering for months probably afterwards. But, you know, so this is how it is. This is the connection that exists in our bodies. We're organized in some ways to run away from dinosaurs. So we still have these mechanisms. But he's wanting us to look at this for a different purpose, and to try to use this to be able to work with work with ourselves better. So the bodily experience, say with fear, he's talking here about how emotions play out in terms of the feelings in the body. Like some emotions arouse the body, like what we were just talking about, and some emotions actually relax the body. And so we can kind of take advantage of that. So with fear, there's increased bodily tension. The muscles are ready to go, and there's an increased heart rate and slow digestion. Your pupils dilate and you get like kind of tunnel vision. You're like set up to run or fight or something. And all of those things will help you run away from the dinosaur or fight the dinosaur or whatever. And then things happen with our attention. So emotions can actually affect how narrow or broad our attention is focused, as well as what we pay attention to. And this has been really well researched. So they've learned that in fight or flight kind of reaction, our attention actually narrows. Even your vision narrows. You have almost like they call it a tunnel vision. So, and then thinking and reasoning, how emotions shape how flexibly we're able to think. and also what we tend to think about. So with, and like we all experience this, like with anger, there's like a narrowing of the mind. You almost can't get off the topic. It's like, that's all that exists. And you're like, well, you can't, it's hard to have a broad perspective when you have anger. But in the flight or fight, because anger is actually a complex emotion. It's not as simple. Even the stuff I read yesterday in the psychological research on in this vein was, it's kind of more complex. Fear was easier. So that's what we're using for this one. So in the flight or fight responses, the thoughts that we have tend to be negative, actually. Our attention tends to go towards negative stimuli. And this is a very important point. The perception of ambiguous situations are seen as negative more than they are. And the reoccurring of negative words happens. So, you know, there's just different things that happen. And sometimes even specific negative thoughts will be associated with a certain emotion. Like, you know, maybe you have like a certain emotion and a certain memory or something comes up. And then there's imagery that is involved. And what Russell's talking about here is emotions involve like a mental imagery, like little pictures or dramas or movies we play out in our mind. And most people who meditate have some awareness of this. Like, it's like a movie show sometimes. Who needs TV, right? And then motivation is, there's impacts on our emotions, organize our minds by influencing our motivations. So emotions help to shape what we find ourselves wanting to do. Like when you're angry, do you really want to go help that person? So, and why we want to do things. So there's these impacts there. And then in terms of the last thing, in terms of our behavior, emotions shape our behavior. We'll behave very differently depending on the emotions that we're feeling. Think about when you're having a good day or a bad day. It's just so easy to see. So we're aware of a lot of this at a certain level. It's also known in this fight or flight that individuals who have higher levels of emotional reactivity will be prone to more anxiety and even aggression. And so this is one thing that I happen to think is quite palpable in our society, I would say, is my way to put it. So that, like, with this kind of, like, our behavior in social situations, for example, relates to pre-existing thoughts that we have. They've proven this, right? And so with fight or flight response, this thing about interpreting ambiguous situations as hostile, actually, I heard a which leads to more aggressive behaviors. I actually heard a thing once where they teach certain kinds of gun safety in a way that makes people, I don't want to say paranoid, but suspicious. And so actually people have gotten shot because people have these pre-existing thoughts that are leading them to interpret situations in a more hostile way than they would have otherwise. These are the kind of things that play out. And actually today, this morning, I looked at some of the, you know, in Google, I put in like safety videos, gun safety videos and perceived threat. There's so much research they've done out there about, you know, it's worth looking at really how safe are we with all these guns around. It's basically not safe. It's proven that it's less safe. And they have all kinds of statistics about this, especially the number of suicides that go up. Oh my gosh. For the one person who is preventing one, you know, an untrained person having a gun, preventing someone else from doing, you know, hurting people. For every one of those you prevent, there were like 88 suicides and 43 criminal offenses and two accidental deaths related to for one prevention of harm due to people carrying guns. I mean, the numbers were just outrageous. So to me, how the mind is working in this is what I'm focused on here. And that then lets us make informed decisions in our lives. So, you know, that's one thing of looking at fear. But then now Russell asks us, let's look at a positive emotion, like affection or joy. And so I chose affection because affection is a quality that we train in here, especially when we do equanimity meditations, which we are very much a part of our tradition, to learn how to have a mind that Well, to realize that I designate a friend, an enemy, and a stranger. Like in one day, a person can be all three in my mind. And this is something we learn by looking at our own minds and experience that we, and through our meditation, we learn that we actually are designating this. And so when we do this equanimity meditation, we realize, wow, not everybody sees that person as a jerk. They're like somebody else's best friend. And we try to make our minds more equanimous. We actually are trying to not become like indifferent. We're actually trying to have a feeling of affection towards another person. And then it's very easy to develop love and compassion and, you know, even get along with people. So that's something that we actively work on here, this sense of warm-hearted affection. It's seeing people in beauty, seeing, you know, like that, worthy of affection. So most people in this room are familiar with our meditations or have spent some time with this. So I picked affection, and I want you to just think in your own experience, when you have a feeling, a warm feeling of affection for someone, what is your body bodily experience then? This is what Russell's asking us to look at. Isn't it more relaxed? Kind of like there's a feeling of safety probably, so it's very easy to relax then. Actually, I think I have this expression from the past, warm hands, warm heart. Because, you know, when you're actually having fear in a certain things, your blood goes to your muscles and your hands get cold. But when you're actually having a lot of warm-heartedness, you can actually, your things, you know, your hands even get warm, I think, sometimes. So you have, you know, your body is, there's certain effects on the body. It's easier to relax. You're not tense and things like that. But how about your attention when you have a feeling of affection? Are you having like this narrow mind that can only think one thing? Or, you know, some of the research showed that with happiness, people have more expansive and creative minds and sometimes even more complacent, actually. So then what do you think? Think in your own mind. What is your mind like? Is it more narrow, more broad? You know, that's what we're exploring here. What's happening? Can we more easily pay attention to positive qualities in someone when you have a feeling of affection for them? That's my experience. If I have a negative feeling towards someone, it's like working upstream, swimming against the grain to try to have a positive, see their positive qualities then, right? And then how about our thinking and reasoning? When you have a feeling of affection for someone, yeah, you could kind of morph into like attachment and superimpose good qualities that aren't there or exaggerate their good qualities. But if it's clean, clear, just a feeling of affection, well, for sure, you're probably not going to impute negative qualities when the mind is like that. You might do less of both if you were really clean, clear about it, not having attachment or, you know, attachment is by definition, you're exaggerating good qualities, and anger by definition, they've even shown this in psychological experiments, is 80, maybe even 90% like projection, negative, you're exaggerating, it's clear. So, you know, just having an equanimous mind with a feeling of affection, you might have more clarity about things that you're encountering. Maybe in terms of the imagery, what do you think when your mind is more at ease? I have much less discursive thought than my mind isn't like running like a faucet that needs to be turned off, you know? So how about motivation? How can you work with your motivation when you have a feeling of affection? It's kind of like easy. This is why we do this. That's what the equanimity meditation in our tradition is done, so that you can develop other good qualities like love, compassion, bodhicitta. We start by kind of leveling things out in the mind so that we can do these things, we can have these, develop these good motivations. And then how about your behavior? Don't you find it easier to act according to your values, especially if you contrast it with anger? If you're angry towards someone versus having a feeling of affection for them, isn't it easier for you to live within your own ethical standards, you know? So it's easier to interact with a feeling of kindness then. So this is, you know, so Russell goes on, considering all these factors together, we can see how our emotions, and particularly the negative ones, can be difficult to manage and how we get caught up in them so easily. It's very complex, actually. A lot going on there. He says they can interact with one another to produce a sort of emotional inertia. So it makes it like your mind is like on this, it's like moving that way, and then you have a hard time turning it, especially with the negative ones. So now he uses the example of anger. So when, for example, when we're angry, we're prone to feeling stimulation and tension in our bodies. Our attention narrowly focuses on the object of our anger. We can't knock it off. You try to meditate when you're angry. It's crazy, crazy making. We tend to be absolutely certain of our own perspective. That's a very narrow mind. We tend to obsess about the situation, repeatedly playing it over in our minds like a movie. That's the imagery part. We're more likely to be motivated to attack. Maybe we'll criticize the other person or say something about them nasty to their face or behind their back. And this is just one emotion. All this is going on with just one emotion. So this is what he's, you know, helping us to see here. And then he tells this story, which I thought was pretty good. For example, let's see, with so many responses to just one feeling, perhaps we can begin to understand how we end up doing silly, counterproductive things when we're in the grip of different emotions. And then here's his story. One of his clients, Jim, decided to quit smoking and had been doing pretty well at it. And he described the feeling of the resisting the urge to smoke as kind of similar to having a powerful urge to act on an emotion. You know that, you know, everybody knows that. Like, ha! It's not like painful, but really uncomfortable, like having an intense itch that he's trying not to scratch. So that was his experience at that point. So then he recounted having been at a bar with a friend of his, having a pint of beer. And then his friend pulls out a cigarette and lights up. And then the craving organized in his mind very quickly in the way that Russell just described. His attention got focused, his motivation got set, his heart rate was picking up, and all this stuff was happening. And then what stuck out most in his memory was how it affected his thinking and his reasoning. And he said, as my friend held out the pack to offer me one, thoughts leapt into my mind. I've done great. 2 weeks with no smoking. It's just one cigarette. It won't matter. I can just have this one and go right back to not smoking. So that was his first set of thoughts. And then he found it quite convincing. So he took a cigarette and had a smoke. And then the next thing that happened was fascinating. From the first puff, my reasoning completely flipped on its head. The stream of thoughts that now came was entirely different. Well, I've screwed it up now. I've been doing well, and now I've blown it. Might as well go and buy a pack of cigarettes. So just this, that's the craving in the mind that did this. It influenced his thinking and then his behavior. So that's a pretty awesome story because it, you know, his, basically what Russell's saying here, how we and everyone we know get hijacked by our emotions. So now he's painted the picture. We kind of see it. And now what are we going to do about it? And so in the previous chapters, especially the one just before, he was talking a lot about awareness is a good start, being mindfully aware of what's going on, what we're thinking, feeling, what we're motivated to do. And that helps us to give, he says, some space in the mind so that we can evaluate and rethink things. Then we can observe and manage these emotions that we're experiencing. We can know how we're like wired and what's going to come up and kind of work with it better. So then it might be like, it might look like, wow, I'm really working hard to convince myself to have this cigarette. Is this really what I want to do? Or is it just part of the craving that I need to learn to resist if I'm going to quit smoking? So you learn what craving does to you. You just see it in three-part harmony and you start to work with it. And I would say from our study here of nonviolent communication, I would really add to this list the understanding of the needs that underlie emotions. For example, we use this format of, there's an observation, like I made up an example to try to explain this. Say I'm talking to someone else and say, Let's see. I was unable to meet you when you returned from the hospital visit. Were you feeling sad or were you feeling frustrated? Because you were needing to hear and be heard, or because you were needing support, or maybe you were needing clarity, you know, maybe you're needing a shared reality. So we've studied in this nonviolent communication that our emotions are underlaid by needs that we have. Like, think of the one about fear. There's a need for safety, probably, a lot of times. You know, there's many, many things that underlie it. And the reason why I bring this up is because most of us, that when we first studied this, and this happened more strongly and vividly for me in the first period of studying this, because actually what we first learned at the Abbey was we weren't aware of our needs. We didn't have names for them. We didn't know what they were. And they were just running the show unbeknownst to us. And this is what many of us here experienced. And so then when we identified truly what the need was, the body had this relaxation that happened. This doesn't happen to me at all anymore, but it used to happen at first where, like, wow, there was just like the mind and the body kind of like, it was marked, it was relaxed, it was palpable. And I think that as I understand this, I was probably becoming more aware of things that were ones that were kind of reoccurring things for my psyche, you know, that come up for me. For me, it's clear to me, even my mom tells me this, from the time I was young, I had a need for like peace. I needed things to be kind of peaceful. And I was a family with six kids. It was loud, and it was pretty chaotic, actually. And I guess when I was in the, my grandma was worried about me when I was in the crib, because I would just sit there very content looking. She said, they thought I was kind of having delayed or something, you know. But I actually think I kind of came in with this, you know. It's still now. And so what happens to me now is sometimes when you interfere with my peace, I have anger. Right? You know, so it's good to know you have this and not rely on other people and situations for that and kind of work with it. So, you know, let's see. So anyway, you have these bodily experiences as you work these things out. I found that as I was more aware of the needs that they were pulling around the emotions. It was the underlying needs a lot that were driving things and my behaviors as well. A lot of the, like, kind of, I don't find myself to be that impulsive. I used to think that before I moved here. But there's a whole class of things where I have a lot of impulsivity. And it turned out that these underlying needs were what were driving it. And once we came aware of that, sometimes I would watch myself do this and I couldn't stop myself even. You know, I just would like, I'm from a family where people interrupt each other all the time. It's part of the norm of how you connect. And here it's like against the grain to do that. It's not acceptable. And so I had to struggle with this for years here and retrain myself. But it also had a lot of the need I had for connection was met in this certain way that we interacted. And it was like not working here at all. You know, and so it was helpful to understand that need and what was driving some of my behaviors. So those are like some examples of, and okay, so we can see our these effects on the body, our attention, our thinking, when your emotions aren't getting hijacked, maybe as you understand these different aspects of your psyche, including the needs, then it's easy to have less like kind of emotional doubt that would come up. Like when I wasn't aware of my needs, I would see that there was more discursiveness in my mind, more kinds of emotional doubt that would come up. My emotions were hijacking me more. It was harder to actually, in this system that we use, we observe, you know, you try to describe in 8 words what happened. It was really hard to do that in 8 words. And it was really hard not to like add on all your interpretations. But once you were like aware of what was going on inside of yourself, you could go back and look calmly and clearly at and make the observation, things like that. You don't have so much drama going on in your mind, all these underlying thoughts that are pushing things, pushing the emotions. So, and then the thing around motivation, well, in Buddhism and in nonviolent communication, motivation comes at the start of all of this. It's the most important thing because of our understanding of karma in Buddhism. A lot of it comes from that. And then our behavior, once we understand these needs, it's really a lot easier to choose helpful words. It's easier to decide how to interact with people using speech that, you know, I have less reactivity, I'm creating less negative karma, all that kind of, it's easier to fall into place. So doing this, having this kind of understanding, is what he's trying to do is have us be compassionate towards ourselves, understanding that this is partly how we're psychologically wired. But I would say not hardwired. We have a lot, and I think as I do more research and they started, I read one thing where they actually were teasing out anger and they were looking at motivation. And I think as they do more studies, they'll start to tease out the different aspects. But in Buddhist practice, this has been going on for, millennia, and people have found that there's ways to work with all of this. And so this is like a combination of the two areas where there's a crossover, an intersection of Buddhist psychology and Western psychology, you might call it that. So Russell goes on and says, take this compassionate understanding even further. We need to grasp there's no reason to blame ourselves for how this works. We didn't choose for this process to play out so powerfully. It's just how our brains at the physical level and our minds at our level of awareness work. So I think there's some truth to that. And then, but it's best, I think, to go on to where he goes to with that, to we can work with these mental activities. As we understand these, we don't have to, as we understand how our emotions work and how it interacts with the rest of our psychological happenings, then we can retake responsibility for the process. And that's where compassion comes in. So he's now setting the stage. We have to understand this in a way where we're not doing what we might do if we didn't look at this with some level of discernment and understanding. We might just judge ourselves, hate ourselves, judge others, hate others. It's just so easy to diagnose, interpret, things like that. We never know what's going on in someone else's mind. So that's not really, you can never know what someone else's emotion or motivation is. It's almost hard to know your own sometimes. So we can see that, addictive craving and emotions like anger organize the mind in powerful ways. I think sometimes that word is too strong for me, organize. I would say influence, because I really, I don't feel like this stuff is set in stone at all. This is why we practice, so that we can work with this differently. So yeah, some things are wired, but I don't think you want to have a thought that locks your ability to change. So I'd say, there's a lot of influences going on there. So we want to use the compassion in our mind to use our thinking ability to our advantage. So instead of doing all this interpreting and whatever, we would use our reasoning process to say, how does it make sense that this person might feel that way? Or what would help this person to feel safe? Or what would be helpful to do in this situation? So it's kind of like, instead of running on reactivity, we'd have compassion in our mind, in our heart. And we'd just wow, what's going on here? Inquisitiveness, curiosity, that helps us to have compassion. So we try to bring about a compassionate state of mind. One thing I think would help is to recognize that one point that he's made here so far, and I kind of wanted to skip over this, but I actually think I want to go back to it. He's saying this is just how the process runs, right? It's kind of like, don't take this stuff so personally, right? Well, I actually like what Shantideva says about this. We have this expression, I think it's Venerable Chirni and I who usually say this to each other, such are his conditions. Is like we take this whole teaching and we take it down to these words, such are his conditions. It's about how do we work with anger. And Shantideva has some verses here that really help us to not take another person's anger so personally. It's kind of like the same idea. Like it's just a process running, right? There's no person there who's intending all of this. So he says, and this is a 6th century great sage in the Buddhist tradition that he was from India, that every Tibetan Buddhist knows his book, and His Holiness quotes it all the time. So in chapter 6, where he focuses on this, he says, "As I do not become angry with great sources of suffering, such as jaundice, then why be angry with animate creatures? They too are provoked by conditions." So just as you get jaundice due to some conditions, anger arises due to conditions. Then he goes on, "Although they are not wished for, these sicknesses arise," the jaundice, right? "Likewise, although they are not wished for, the disturbing conceptions forcibly arise." We all have that experience. These things just, they just show up. We don't wish for them. You don't wake up in the morning like, yeah, I want to get angry today at everybody. That's not really what we do. "Without thinking, I shall be angry, people become angry with no resistance. And without thinking, I shall produce myself, likewise, anger itself is produced. All mistakes that are all the various kinds of," he uses the word evil, I don't like that word, "arise through the force of conditions. They do not govern themselves. These conditions assemble together and have no intention to produce anything. And neither does their product have the intention to be produced." It's like you got a cascade going, and there you are. These are all the conditions. Now, we have some control, some level of control over the conditions. That's why we do our Dharma practice. But to think that you're going to be able to just to stop this by saying, I don't want to be angry. Well, a lot of us have tried to do that. I sit in the meditation hall and work on this, and I just walk out the door and whammo. Sometimes anger just arises, like, quickly. You know, and we all laugh about that because everybody has done that. You know, it's like, I don't have the intention. And then, but, you know, you have to be careful how you work with that, because there is some level of choice. And a lot of that depends on the conditions. And for me, going back to what he's teaching here, I'm just going to kind of skip towards the end. So one way that this works for me, like, say we want to have a compassionate mental state, and we understand the teachings of karma, which I didn't have much time to review, but in fact didn't. How would this work for us, right? What would it look like? So for me, one thing I'm quite clear on is I have to, of the six things he gave, he sometimes put the body at the end. I have to put it at the beginning. For myself, it's really important for me to take time to actually keep myself slowed down. I just think I have a lot of physical and mental restlessness, and it interferes. And it interferes with my ability to live in the way I want to live in relationship to others. And so I spend time with this because this is what works for me. So, you know, how would you go about that? You know, what do you need? Because everybody's kind of, we're all kind of wired differently. Like for me, I usually use breathing meditation now because it's so palpable helps to cut anxiety, helps to slow my thinking. So I can kind of enter this day with, you know, it's just so much easier for me to come to the kind of mental states I want to have towards things. If I'm running around and all revved up, then everything goes too fast for me and I get into trouble. That's my mind. So then when we go to the next thing, like attention and thinking, I want to give some teachings and motivation, things about that. Geshe Sopa says, like, for Buddhists, the most important thing to do in the beginning is to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. That's how we enter into the teachings of the Buddha deeply. And then the next step is to examine causality, which is what we've been talking about today. He's talking about taking examples from your own experience, which is exactly what we're doing in this chapter, until you're convinced, and now he's talking about karma, that positive actions result in happiness and non-virtue leads to unhappiness. For a Buddhist, this kind of thinking is a real cornerstone for living an ethical life and engaging in spiritual training. You might not need all of that for just this life, but if you're going to follow the Buddhist path, which is much more than about just this life, you need a lot of motivation and a lot of these kind of understandings. He says, to obtain happiness and avoid misery, you have to accumulate their causes. from a Buddhist perspective, the cause of happiness is virtue, practicing virtue, and the cause of misery is practicing non-virtue. But it's not easy to control your actions. It requires great mental and physical effort. So you have to have some kind of confidence in the path or your practice or whatever your tradition is in order to do it. You can't change your attitudes and your behavior without a lot of confidence in what you're doing because it's a lot of work. And he goes on to explain this a little more clearly. So he says, in terms of like, this relates a lot to the motivation and attention part of this chapter. He says, most negative actions are done out of ignorance. This is a Buddhist perspective. We just don't know that they're wrong, or we don't know the advantages, the disadvantages of doing them. So in the Buddhism, that's why we study and listen to teachings. We have to learn things. There's a lot of things that just looking at, like, studying in Buddhism, the 10 destructive actions, a lot of confusion that I grew up in this society was just cleared away from just focusing on the Buddhist ethics. But unfortunately, learning the cause and effect of karma does not automatically eliminate all harmful actions. You can't just learn about things and expect that you're going to be able to change your behaviors. It's just not that simple. Even when you know what you're doing, negative actions will still arise frequently. It may be that you're not paying attention. Sometimes, you know, like me, if I get going too fast, it's all too fast for me. Or maybe your habits are too strong. And from a Buddhist perspective, we carry these habits from life to life. It's the most important aspect of the results of karma. It's the only one. The results of karma are things like maybe what realm you're born in or what kind of things you experience in this life or the environmental effects. But the only one that's actually negative of all those are considered like neutral. They may be suffering, but suffering itself is neutral. What's negative are the habits that we take from life to life. Because why? Well, if you have a habit of being angry, anger is naturally going to lead to negative actions, just naturally. So this is the one that's the biggest thing. And we have a lot of habits. And that's what's beautiful about this book that Russell has written. He's helping us to see that, hey, we can create new habits. Just like the path to Venerable's cabin out there, the one that we quit using, it's almost all grown over already because we just quit using it. That's the way Russell teaches this. If you keep mowing one area, it's a nice path. But if you just quit mowing it and, you know, mow a new path and keep mowing that path, now you have a new path. Same with our habits. We just create virtuous habits and try to diminish the other ones. So these teachings first tell us what you have to pay attention to, what you're doing, and then you have to bring your actions in harmony with what the teachings advise. And this practice starts out with observing your motivation. All actions start there. It's the intention behind the action that drives the action. This is the Buddhist standpoint. It's the intention that makes the karma negative or positive. And for us, our motivations aren't always clear, and sometimes they're mixed. And I really like that he brings this up because that was very clear to me when I first moved here. And that's great to see that because you can clean them up. We have a lot of mixed motivations. We start good, and it kind of sours, and pretty soon we have mixed motivations. And once you recognize that, you just clean them up. It's all malleable. You can have a profound understanding of virtuous and non-virtuous karma and still be motivated by fear or some other confusing affliction that leads you to act in a negative way. And this kind of confusion can lead even advanced practitioners into acting in a deceitful manner. This Geshe who's speaking was very learned. I mean, he was a practitioner and a scholar, and I would say a yogi. So for real practitioners, the real practice is not blaming someone else for your faults, not keeping an eye on someone else's poor qualities, not worrying about what other people are saying, doing, or thinking. You never really know what's going on in another person's mind. The real practitioner is thinking, what am I doing? What am I thinking? How am I dealing with the situation in front of me? That's what we work with. And the things in this chapter can help us to tease it apart in your own experience. You take this, you know, try to understand what he says in the chapter, and then you take it to the cushion. So I think that kind of gives some idea of what the chapter is about and some kind of Buddhist spin on it or understanding. Does anyone have any comments they'd like to make? Or I'm not sure if any questions, but yeah.
So one of the things I think I have difficulty with from the psychology standpoint is the fight or flight thing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is part of the Buddhist approach would be like, because the duality of it, right? Fight or flight. But mm-hmm. might there be a third option, like sitting calmly, quietly?
Oh, right? Yeah. That's kind of my point. Like these things aren't hardwired. And I don't think they're really saying they're hardwired either. I think they're just saying this is, it's clear that when these things come up, like I'm just saying it from my own perspective as a physiology major and a Buddhist and a meditator. As these things come up, things are going to be going on in your body. You're going to have different hormones and they're going to have different impacts on you. And you can watch this happen. You can watch, wow, when there's anger or things, how your thinking narrows. Everything described in here, you can watch. When you're on the cushion, you can look back at experiences, look back at the things that disturb your mind, and if you can work with them in constructive ways, you can see all this. But that's why I'm saying it's not hardwired, because then when these things come up in you, like if you can recognize them early, even children understand this. You know, they taught compassion meditation to children that were really young, like elementary school, and they used the analogy of like a fire. Like if you have a little... You know, if I have a little match burning here and I let it go in this field out here, pretty soon I'm going to have a forest fire. Well, if I catch it early, it's easy to put it out. And so this is the whole point of this. Some of it is, yeah, we have bodies. Bodies have physiology. We have mind and body connection. And these things are going to come up. But you can learn to recognize these things. You can learn to actually watch your mind narrow and broaden. You know, you can actually recognize this in yourself, and then you can learn to work with it. The other people can make comments about that. I mean, it's like, it's so automatic, some of it. Like, for instance, when we do winter retreat, we do 6 sessions a day, 5 in the hall and 1 study. And some years, when you do that, the clarity in the mind, the quickness that you see things arising in your mind and what's happening and transpiring, it's this clarity is just, it's the most beautiful part of it in my mind. And there's some years where I haven't even done but 2 sessions a day because I was working on a project around here. And even then, that clarity would come just from the conditions around me. And so that really helped me to see, like, the conditions we put ourselves in are really important. And I think this is from a Buddhist perspective and from the way Venerable Chodron teaches, why she teaches the way she teaches. She'll always say, like, you never know what you've done in previous lives, and something could come out of left field at any time. So she's the most careful person I know about what conditions she'll put herself in because of this. Literally, it was one of the first things I learned as a monastic. Like, she would never put herself in some of the conditions I would routinely put myself in. Just like walking from a park in Seattle to my home 3 miles through this dark, isolated area, you know, she would not have put herself in that kind of condition. And I realized after I was a monastic, I better get a ride. you know, it's like that kind of thing. And this is this is how we can work with our mind. This is the part we have some control over. Yeah, some of these things are so ingrained and so habitual that they'll come up quite quickly. It can seem automatic. There's probably some time in there that it's so short that we can't do it. But once we are aware of the conditions we put ourselves in, we can control that. And that's what we're trying to do during the day, and that's what we're trying to do when we die. We want to have a virtuous mind. We want the conditions within our mind and around us, hopefully, to be such that our virtuous karma ripens. So, yeah, it's kind of seeing the interplay and then working with it. I would never say this stuff is hardwired. It doesn't make any sense. There's nothing really hardwired in the body. You know, even neurophysiologically, I mean, I haven't studied this stuff for a long time, but I know our DNA is changing according to environmental conditions. Our synapses are forming and degenerating depending on how we use them. Even the ligaments in your body, when they used to transplant tendons into knees to make a ligament, that tendon material, which was morphologically tendon, would become ligament in material over time. You know, it just, the forces of the biophysics would change it. Things are changing left and right. So to say that something's hardwired is kind of hard.